from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
And from 90.3 WCPN in Cleveland, I'm Amy Eddings.
And we're teaming up this hour to bring you a special show we're calling Swap Talk.
Giving listeners in Ohio and California a chance to talk to each other about the issues that matter to them.
This hour, the tense relationship between police and communities of color. Oakland's police came under federal supervision back in 2003.
In Cleveland, shootings by white police officers of African Americans such as Tamir Rice prompted federal oversight in 2015. President Trump has said such efforts are unnecessary.
We want to hear from you. You can follow this discussion on Twitter at WCPN and KQED Forum. It's all next after the news. Welcome to Swap Talk, the third in a series of conversations KQED Forum is having with other NPR stations across the country. Today, we're co-hosting a joint broadcast between KQED in San Francisco and WCPN in Cleveland. I'm Michael Krasny, the host of Forum.
And I'm Amy Eddings, the host of Morning Edition here at 90.3 WCPN. Swap Talk is a chance to hear how different communities across the country are grappling with the issues that matter to them.
This hour, the strained relationship between police and minority communities. Oakland's police came under the supervision of a federal court order back in 2003 after police abuse by a group of rogue officers dubbed the Riders, and the city is still trying to meet reforms over 14 years later.
And in Cleveland, the 137 shots police chase and fatal shootings of two unarmed African Americans in 2012 sparked a federal probe by the U.S. Department of Justice and Cleveland's decision to make reforms and have them approved by a federal judge, an agreement known as a consent decree. You'll be hearing that word a lot tonight. President Trump thinks such federal oversight is counterproductive. His Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said consent decrees reduce police morale and actually lead to more crime. So, is federal oversight the solution to local police problems? Or is it the problem? And what can our two cities learn from each other?
That's going to be our discussion this hour, and you can follow this conversation on Twitter with the hashtag SwapTalk. We also want to hear from you, so tweet us, and we'll open the phone lines later this hour.
We're going to talk to different people from Oakland and Cleveland who are involved in these issues, but first, to give us a quick sense of the types of federal oversight operating in each city, we're joined by Jim Shannon. He's one of the lawyers from that 2003 police abuse case that Michael mentioned, where they negotiated for federal oversight of the Oakland Police Department as part of a settlement agreement. Jim, what's the difference between your settlement agreement and Cleveland's consent decree? Both cities' reforms are being overseen by a federal judge, right?
That's correct. Good morning. We do not have the Department of Justice involved in our agreement. We're just about the only place. I'm not familiar with all of them, but I don't know of any others that are privately done. John Burris and I sued the city of Oakland in 2000. We represented 129 individuals, 128 of which were African American. They had drugs planted on them by a number of officers, the biggest one being Frank Vasquez, who's fled the country when a warrant was issued for his arrest and has not been seen again, at least by anyone I know. We had been suing the city of Oakland for about 20 years prior to that. And we just went to the city attorney and said, look, this isn't working. The idea of suing and reforming, we need a consent decree, and we're not going to settle unless we have one. So that's how our agreement happened. In most other cities, our role is played by the Department of Justice, as in Cleveland, who came in and initiated a lawsuit themselves.
Let's go macro for a moment. Do you think that the black and blue divide was exacerbated under then-President Obama and his attorneys general, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, who were more proactive in investigating local police forces for civil rights and constitutional violations?
No, quite the contrary. I think that at least they tried. Not every one of their actions were successful, but I think they made an effort. And I do think these consent decrees, various results in various cities, but I do think they do help. Just because they don't solve everything doesn't mean they don't help at all.
Let's talk about whether it's solving problems in Oakland. Oakland PD have been notoriously resistant to the settlement agreements reforms. And as Michael mentioned at the beginning, nearly 15 years later, there are still problems. Most recently, a sexual exploitation scandal involving an underage sexually exploited teen and multiple cops on the force, including an officer who killed himself. What's the top reason? I'm sure there's many. What's the top reason for the failure of Oakland PD to get out from under this?
Well, the top reason for the failure is just what you said, because the sex scandal, because we were ready to let them out and go into the one-year sustainability period in 2014, 2015, no later than 2016. But then when this happened, we had to put that on hold. Because the Oakland police have changed quite a bit. Uses of force, for example, are down from 2,000 in 2008 to 500 today. Complaints are down. We had no shootings in 2014 or 2016, which is the first time that's ever happened. The arrests are up. Crime is down. So the argument that's being made by the Trump administration doesn't hold with us. So they were doing a good job. And then this happened. It was a big setback. We lost the chief and then two more. But I don't think you can say that because of this one scandal that the thing was a failure. People are human beings. And they make mistakes. The issue is how you handle it, not that they'll never make mistakes.
And yet it's stunning that even under scrutiny, the police officers on the Oakland force engaged in this behavior.
Yes. Yes, it was. But as I said before, when you have a 700-person force like Oakland, you simply can't expect that everyone's going to behave themselves all the time. The issue is not will everyone behave themselves, because they won't, just like any group of 700 people. The issue is how will the command and the supervisor structure respond to a problem such as a sex scandal.
Oakland's reform process was initiated as the result of a lawsuit that the city lost. Cleveland's reform process this time around was triggered by Mayor Frank Jackson, who requested federal help. Carol Rendon, the former U.S. attorney for Northeast Ohio who negotiated Cleveland's consent decree, said that led to a more collaborative partnership. Let's take a listen.
We worked hand in hand with the city of Cleveland to negotiate the consent decree that was jointly presented to Judge Oliver for his approval. So this was not a situation where the Department of Justice came in and sued the city of Cleveland and it was an adversarial proceeding, but rather we jointly presented to him what we had negotiated as the, in the best interest of the Cleveland Division of Police and the city of Cleveland.
Jim Shannon, do you think your civil lawsuit is partially to blame for the Oakland PD's lack of cooperation? Do you think police would be farther along if the settlement agreement went through the DOJ?
No, because the process that the woman from the Department of Justice just described is exactly what happened with our consent decree. It was a collaborative process. It was written by two experts from our side and two experts from the city of Oakland. It was jointly presented to Judge Henderson. In fact, he made that point yesterday that this was not forced on them. This was agreed to by them. Now, there was a lawsuit. We represented 129 people who did 40 years in prison for crimes they didn't do. So after that was settled for $10.5 million, then we moved on to the consent decree and negotiated it. So there are more similarities than differences between the two decrees, that the one described and ours.
I've looked at some of the outstanding reform goals for Oakland. A lot of them are procedural. Fill out a form when you pull someone over. Fill out a form when you discharge your firearm. be supervised by the same commanding officer for a certain period of time. I'd like to bring in my guest, Mark Hoy, who served as a patrol officer in Cuyahoga County and in Columbus for 15 years. Mark, welcome to SWAP Talk. You told us of a police reform effort in Cincinnati involving paperwork that appears to have backfired. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first off, good morning. Thank you for the invitation to be here with you this morning. Throughout different consent decrees and different reviews, the element of having to fill out a form or to document a simple act of pulling a firearm for, say, a traffic stop or something along those lines has become an issue sometimes with officers who, again, are trying to do their job, and it's the path of least resistance. So it's that second guessing of, well, do I really want to fill out a form and then be reviewed by my supervisor, my supervisor's supervisor, and so on from that point.
And what did you hear from officers in Cincinnati?
It was an issue when it came out, and there was that almost tensity you could feel between the officers and the supervision.
And you say that they've stopped pulling out their guns as a result because they don't want to fill out the form?
Or? Some officers, yeah, reviewed that with us as well.
Jim Shannon, is more paperwork the solution here?
Well, I don't think more paperwork is the point or the solution. I think that documenting use of force is important. We do not have the resistance to that Mr. Hoy just described happened in Cincinnati. I'm sure that the officers don't like it, but there has to be some accountability. And I think we've managed to reduce uses of force, reduce the drawing of the firearm without compromising officer safety. And I think that's a good thing. And I think the documentation has helped.
Mark McLean is a former prosecutor who's worked in both the U.S. Attorney's Office and in the city of Cleveland's law department in the late 80s, early 90s. He's Black. He's attended all the public forums hosted by the monitoring team. He told me consent decrees, the way they're currently structured, cannot get at the relationship problems at the heart of police misuse of force among communities of color. Let's take a listen.
That's the flaw of the consent decree. By just concentrating on the police versus the people, the black and blue divide, as you termed it, there should be prosecutors involved in this. There should be judges involved in this. There should be the school system involved in this. There should be every single important faction involved in this community should be involved in this.
Jim, do you think the process would be better served if it weren't just the cops and the courts and the community advocates working on this issue?
Well, it's always better to have more voices. And so I would welcome any idea that would bring more people into our process. However, I think as it is, it's really worked wonders. Another thing that happened is we had complaints drop in half. A lot of that had to do with the introduction of cameras. But I think there's been a real culture change in Oakland police. Obviously, we'll never be police. We are not police. And we can't understand everything they do. But you could make that argument about having a military dictatorship because the president isn't a member of the military. So I think at some point you have to have civilian input, and I think ours has worked well. There definitely have been problems and setbacks, but I think we're moving forward, and I think it's been a net plus.
Now, this is a SWAP Talk with KQED and Michael Krasny. I'll give you the mic in just one moment. I have one last question to ask Jim Shannon. There's a perception that I've heard from primarily white Republican voters in Cleveland suburbs that all these efforts are directed at the wrong people, that it's the people police are encountering who should go through anger management or sensitivity training. Tom Rosso is a personal trainer in Bay Village who's displayed Blue Lives Matter signs in his front yard and who has relatives who are cops.
It's very simple. You know, if you did something wrong, police officer approaches you, yes sir, no sir, right? And you go from there. Some of the officers, you know, feel that if they get out of the car, they don't know what they're coming up to. So if they were able to have their gun in their hand, but then the ACLU come in And they're like, well, you know what? That's intimidating people. That scares them into doing, you know, stuff that they wouldn't normally do. I just get kind of upset about that.
Jim Shannon, what should the rules of engagement be, and who gets to decide?
Well, I think to a certain extent the police get to decide if their life is in danger and there's a legitimate reason to draw their firearm. I think that's appropriate. But to get out of the car with your gun drawn, just as a matter of course, first of all, it reduces your options. You now have a gun in your hand. Obviously, yes, it does intimidate people and scare them. And I'm not sure that's a good way to engage in community relations. So it really depends on when the officer gets out of the car who they're encountering. But to have automatically draw a gun, I think, is inappropriate.
You're listening to Swap Talk on 90.3 WCPN in Cleveland and KQED in San Francisco. I'm Amy Eddings, where I'm joined by Michael Krasny. Michael, back to you.
Thank you, Amy. And again, this is a special broadcast between WCPN in Cleveland and KQED here in San Francisco. It's part of a special series of shows that KQED Forum is having with NPR stations across the country that we're calling Swap Talk. And we do want to hear from you. Do you think federal intervention works when it comes to reforming police departments? Why or why not? And how can police improve their relationship with communities of color? You can call us toll-free at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or tag us on Twitter using the hashtag SwapTalk. And I'm going to go back to Mark Hoy, who, again, is a longtime patrol officer in suburban Cuyahoga County. And I want to turn to what people in Cleveland are thinking. In 2015, two white police officers responded to a call about a black male with a gun. It ended in the shooting death of a 12-year-old African-American boy named Tamir Rice, who was holding a toy gun. And in the aftermath, the Cleveland Police Department was placed under the supervision of the Department of Justice per the terms of consent decree. The officer who shot Tamir Rice, Timothy Lohman, was recently fired, not for the boy's shooting, but because he had not disclosed on his job application that he had been deemed emotionally unstable and unfit for duty to his previous job. So let's go back to you, Mark Hoy. And the real question is, just how much does this consent decree, now it's fairly early on in the stage in Cleveland, but really work toward, well, diminishing that divide between what's often characterized as black and blue, and particularly diminishing the lack of trust that exists between police and the black community?
Well, in my opinion, and not being a member of the Cleveland Police Department, from the suburban view and from my contacts within the police department, it's an increased sense of accountability for the actions that are taken out there on a day-to-day basis. For instance, contacts with certain situations and scenarios now get that extra light shined on it from point to point and day to day.
Well, it's supposed to be reform for the police. I mean, that's really the purpose behind it, and taking away excess force, which is in violation of the Constitution and federal law. But as we heard from police officer, and as certainly I've heard from police officers, there's resentment, and there's a feeling maybe it's interfering with the work the police do. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has said as much, and actually let's hear what President Trump had to say.
Well, there is a divide, but I have to say that the police are absolutely mistreated and misunderstood. And if there is an incident, whether it's a incident done purposely, which is a horror, and you should really take very strong action, or if it's a mistake, it's on your newscasts all night, all week, all month, and it never ends. The police in this country have done an unbelievable job of keeping law and order, and they're afraid for their jobs. They're afraid of the mistreatment they get. And I'm telling you that not only me speaking, minorities all over the country, they respect the police of this country, and we have to give them more respect.
Well, certainly President Trump's been a big fan of the feds stepping in to curtail the police. Has not been a big fan, I should say, of that. And the reality, Mark Hoy, is that there is resentment in the police officers who have to deal with the day-to-day situations in the community, and there's resentment that comes from the community. How much of the onus ought to be in a consent decree on the police, because it seems that's where most of the onus is, most of the responsibility is, and on the community?
Well, the amount of onus that's placed on a police officer is just that much more that a regular officer has to face on a regular shift schedule. Now there's an extra added, what am I going to do, extra thoughts, extra time, and extra process that's from any function, something as simple as writing, let's say, a traffic ticket to handling a domestic violence case. So there's a lot of onus on that. But one of the big things within the consent decree and the administrations and the collaborative efforts, especially here in Ohio, is engaging community members as well to also provide some oversight and again, cooperation and education in between the police and both the public.
Well, let me go to one of those community members in Cleveland. Kareem Henton is a founding member of Black Lives Matter in Cleveland. Kareem, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. And what about the responsibility? Is it largely on the police shoulders here? I mean, or how much of it goes to the community?
Okay, well, good morning. What I would like to first say in regards to that is that, for example, here in Cleveland, the Department of Justice came in because there were numerous Fourth Amendment right violations on the part of police. They didn't come here because the community had done anything wrong. They came here because the police were violating the rights of citizens. So therefore, you cannot victim blame the citizens and say, well, here's what you can do to make sure that your rights are not going to be violated so much by law enforcement.
No, I'm not suggesting that the citizens are necessarily reasonably concerned or ought to be taking on collective blame here. What I was really getting at was the feeling that there's real adversity in certain parts of the black community and real anger toward the police. And we're talking about a police culture that really needs to be changed, but also maybe some attitudes within the community?
Well, yes, but, you know, even that goes into understanding that you're dealing with a segment of society that are largely disenfranchised. And so, therefore, you have to deal with the fact, why is it that they're like that? Why are they distrusting of police? So, therefore, once you start to really question what the underlying reasons are, then you have to you have a responsibility to deal with things with a certain amount of empathy.
Don't you?
You have to look at.
I was just going to also just insert for a moment the fact that many African Americans within the black community want officers to do their job, want them to enforce the law, don't they?
Oh, well, absolutely. But, you know, at the same time, we need and want for them to do their jobs in an humane way. We want them to go by the rules in which they were given, and we want those laws to be humane and not necessarily detrimental to the lives of people of color, as they have shown thus far.
All right, thank you, Kareem. Let me go back to you, Amy.
You're listening to Swap Talk, a special co-brought broadcast between KQED in San Francisco and WCPN in Cleveland. We want to hear from you. Do you think there's a so-called blue-black divide or rift between police and residents in your community? Do you think federal intervention works when it comes to reforming police departments? What questions do you have about this for people living in the San Francisco Bay Area or Cleveland on this topic? And how can police improve their relationship with communities of color? You can call us toll-free at 866-733-6786.
Welcome back to Swap Talk, the third in a series of conversations that KQED Radio here in San Francisco is having with NPR listeners across America. I'm Michael Krasny here in San Francisco.
And I'm Amy Eddings at WCPN in Cleveland. We're talking about the tension between police and communities of color in the wake of fatal shootings and whether federal oversight of police departments helps. We want to hear from you. How has your community responded to the divide between police and residents? Do you think federal intervention does the job? What questions do you have about this for people living in the San Francisco Bay Area or in Cleveland on this topic? Call us toll-free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or follow our conversation on Twitter with the hashtag SwapTalk.
And we are indeed going to go to calls here forthwith. But first, I want to go back to Kareem Henton, who I was speaking with before we went to that break. He's, once again, a founding member of Black Lives Matter Cleveland. And again, Kareem, I'd like to get you on the record here about what you think with respect to the consent decree. As I said earlier, it's kind of early in the process, but do you think it's moving forward in a way that's appropriate and that's really going to help?
So to answer that quite bluntly, no. I've been attending the meetings with the Cleveland Community Police Commission, as well as the updates that we get from the monitor. And what I have seen thus far is there are great things that I've seen as far as what they've been drafting as far as policy, but then it gets undone in regards to how some of these things are going to be applied, because it appears that the city, which is a smart move on their part to try to thwart things, they've been able to inject certain rules that allow them to perhaps, I would say, create loopholes or create ways in which they can escape accountability. And I'm seeing this firsthand.
So you're suggesting that the police culture is too tied in with the city and those who are running the city?
That is correct. And also you have to keep in mind you have the collective bargaining agreement. That so the police unions have an effective tool in the collective bargaining agreement, and so they will utilize that. For example, with the officers who were involved in the 137 shots incident, those, you know, you had officers who were let go as a result of that. Well, now they're in the process of being brought back in, and that is because of the power given to arbitrators. So that is a thing that is not being dealt with in this city. So until you have consent decrees, until you have the monitors, the, you know, people on the federal level dealing with things such as the power of arbitrators and the collective bargaining agreements, you know, we're pretty much going to see things stay the same. There's going to be a lot of officers escaping accountability.
But there are monitors as part of this consent decree. I mean, I read the consent decree, and it's going to be monitored and implemented after the monitoring goes on.
But if the rules that they have are circumvented by way of the powers of arbitrators, then it's all for naught.
Okay. We're going to go to a caller now. Kevin is in Cleveland. He joins us. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Thank you for joining us.
My comment is this. The double standards or the hypocrisy shows up all the time. Just yesterday or the day before, there was a police officer shot in outside of Akron. I can't remember the small town, but it was all over the news. Anyway, the gentleman that shot him was white, and according to what I heard on the news, he came out with gun in hand, and the police gave him an opportunity to put the gun down. He had been in trouble with the police before in the past. He did not put the gun down. He shot an officer, and then he was killed. Had that been a black man, I highly believe they would have given equal opportunity, just as they did that gentleman there.
All right, Kelvin, I thank you for the call, and would you like to respond? Let me go back to you, if I may.
Kareem?
Yes, well, I mean, in regards to what the gentleman just mentioned, we've seen too many times where officers, because like in, for example, the case of Tamir Rice, officers often in the case of people of color, but not only, they manufacture instances where they create a need for a life and death situation. So therefore, by not necessarily approaching a situation from a safe standpoint, they create this life or death situation, which results in them justifying a murder. If they actually did things in a safe manner, followed safe protocol, then these people wouldn't be getting killed. So what you have are officers who are arbitrarily deciding when they do and when they don't do things in a safe manner and actually utilize, you know, proper discretion.
We're going to go back to Amy Eddings, who has some comments from listeners to read. Amy, before you do that, though, I'm just wondering, doesn't this consent decree also include some partnerships working, for example, to develop partnerships between police and, well, health professionals, for example, and those who work with substance abuse problems and the like?
It's a wide range of goals, but, yeah, more sensitivity to responding to people with emotional disturbances. There's a whole initiative going on there. Effort to get better technology in patrol cars. Cleveland recently purchased 65 new police vehicles. Now, this purchasing agreement was done before this consent decree. It takes a while to process that kind of purchase for a city. But Mayor Jackson was touting that it has all this new technology and computers in the cop cars so that police officers will spend less time traveling back to their precincts to file reports. They can do it online and submit it online. That's supposedly going to free them up for more interaction, face-to-face interaction and community building with communities of color. And so there's efforts that are starting to inch forward as this consent decree unfolds. I'd like to go to a comment that David wrote to us. He says, I'm most interested in finding out if there are effective ways to counter the blue wall of silence among police officers who are trained to never admit that a fellow police officer did anything wrong. It seems that the police union follows the same short-sighted policy that goes against justice, furthers the divide between police and citizens, and leads to less trust. I'm not sure if police officers are trained to never admit that a police officer did anything wrong, but certainly it's part of a military culture. And Mark Hoy, you were talking about that bonding that occurs when you're a newbie in the academy. I'm wondering, I read this from criminal justice writer Joe Dominic of the Crime Report. He writes, many street cops are loyal first and foremost to each other. Solidarity matters more to them than some abstract constitutional principle. Is that true?
I would think that the level of bond in between officers is very pertinent within the job and how we get things done. However, I think it's also readily evident, even with the cases that we've discussed here today, is that especially in Oakland's case, the truth does come out. So the officers who maintain that wall of silence or believe that they're maintaining that wall of silence will eventually be found out. And as to use a coin, the cream always rises to the top. So I think also throughout that, within the use of different cameras and different scrutinizing methods that are out there, I have felt through my experience there's less of that wall of silence in between officers.
Michael, back to you.
Well, let's take another call. We have a lot of people who want to join this discussion, and let's go to Rod here in Pacifica, which is south of San Francisco. Rod, join us.
Thank you for letting me speak again, Michael. I'm a San Francisco Bay Area resident, but I lived 7 years in Northeast Ohio. KQED had a really interesting show on sometime in the last 24 hours talking about what adrenaline does in terms of making people behave much differently than they would normally. And it seems like there are other countries that we might take a look at that manage to keep things at a lower key and keep their police safer and also shoot fewer people. I'm looking at the statistics from 2016, and in the UK they had six people killed out of a population of 70,000. Well, that's about twice what California has, and the same year we had 130 people killed. So that's more than 10 times as many people killed by police. When you escalate things with high-speed chases and people reaching for their guns really quickly rather than standing down, it raises the level, and I think our results are not as good as other places. I'm wondering if we're looking as a country and as a state at other places that manage to do a better job in terms of keeping.
Yeah, Rod, let me interrupt you because I think we get the pith of the question you're asking. It's a question that often comes up when we talk about problems of police violence or problems between black and blue and the like. And Mark Hoy, let's bring you back on this. Certainly you hear about other countries and how they may do the job better without using weapons or without the quickness of bringing weapons and lethal force into the picture. But what do the police have to say about this generally?
Well, you can look at different countries and different systems and mannerisms in which laws are enforced. And quite frankly, we've come a long way within the United States itself with less lethal, with de-escalation techniques, and just in a mere 20 years look back, how far law enforcement has come, no one 30, 50 years ago would have had the idea that we would have the techniques that we have today. Now, is some of that come from other societies and things? Yes, sure. And I think that there's more to be learned from that. But we have come a long way as far as how the job is performed on the street level.
Thank you for that. And let me go back to Amy, who has some comments to read from both Cleveland and San Francisco. Amy?
Ray writes from Cleveland, I believe federal oversight is a start and a decent try, but ultimately it will fall short of what really needs to happen, which is more training, implicit bias training, more diversity training and de-escalation training, legislation that requires at least 65% of police being from neighborhoods in which they patrol is also needed. Mark, I'm wondering if you can describe the kind of de-escalation training that he's talking about, how that works, and whether you have found that in your own work to be helpful.
Absolutely. So de-escalation techniques from just the basic art of listening to what somebody has to say, rather than coming up to a scene or an incident with a preconceived notion as an officer. That type of training is absolutely, there's no value that I could put on that. And that ability to listen, to think, and to process, and the training that comes before that to instill those skills is something that I think is beneficial to all forms of law enforcement, not just street patrol, but also the corrections environment, the security environment, many other types of aspects.
You were telling me of a particular incident in which you responded to a hit and run involving two African Americans who were in the vehicle and were in need of your assistance. How did tell me about that situation and tell me how you used or found that you didn't use de-escalation techniques?
Well, just the simple presence to try and calm a situation is always present. And no matter what the race or what the sex or origin of anybody who we're dealing with is. But a lot of times being able to humanize the purpose of which the police serves.
Well, what happened in that incident?
Initially, the motorists were upset, and in trying to collect simple information to try and identify who the person who hit the motorist was, but that turned into not so nice comments made towards myself as an officer. So the de-escalation technique was, listen, I'm here to help you. That's what I'm here to do. I'm just here to collect some simple information to find the person who did this or to help try and find that. So the more we can discuss, the more we can find common ground, the better, and get to that root source of the problem.
And how did it escalate? They thought you weren't understanding them or treating them respectfully, or what happened?
Just a simple arrive on scene, and again, you get there, and the adrenaline is up, not only from the victims of it, but also the officers who show up, and just a simple asking of questions. Who are you? What happened? I need to know what's going on so that way I could help you.
Could I jump in here for a moment just to ask Mark
a
question? Mark, you mentioned Cincinnati before, where if you draw a gun, you have to write a report. The officers don't want to do that kind of paperwork, and actually more were injured or shot at as a result. That's my understanding.
There was an issue, and this was referred to me several years ago, Cincinnati being one of those departments. Statistically, as far as injuries and et cetera, I don't have anything in front of me that I can refer to on that, but it can be implied that additional work or paperwork for anybody is a little bit more auspicious, and you start to lose the ability to that humanization to go out there and to do the work. And spend, instead of time talking to somebody and getting to, again, the root source problem, you have to go back and then fill out paperwork and do X, Y, and Z.
Let me bring Kareem Henton back into this. Kareem, you've been listening to this conversation, and I'd like to know your thoughts, particularly in light of the fact that I believe you've said you don't feel that the police have enough empathy. So what can be done to enhance that or to, for that matter, elevate their sense of empathy?
So... it is my belief that they need to have training in regards to their implicit biases. So, you know, I will kind of bring in the story that my fellow panelist was giving in regards to that traffic stop. So in a situation like that in which I find myself in, I am the one who was in the accident. I mean, or rather, I was the one who was struck from behind. And when the officers arrived on the scene, they began to ask me if I was insured And once they got that information, they began to ask the female motorist, who was white, what exactly happened. And who would not find that to be insulting? Who would not actually find that to be a situation in which one would feel like, you know, something not in my favor is about to go down? And so, like that, I'm not saying that that's what happened in that case, in his case, but I'm saying that we read things differently. And just this story that I'm telling you right now, he and the other officers need to understand that the way you approach these situations with us, it's all based on prior experiences. And so therefore, you have to bear these things in mind when you're dealing with us. And we have good reason to feel that the way that we feel, and it's because of these bad prior experiences. So they need to be educated to that.
Didn't you also have an experience where you actually said hello to a police officer and nodded at them, or at least try to be affable, and they move their lips in a way that suggested profanity?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that you'll notice, you know, in the cities that I've traveled to, you know, around our nation, is that police oftentimes portray themselves as a gang. They ride around, they have their sunglasses on, they're avoiding eye contact, and you can't even get much of an acknowledgement or a friendly hello gesture out of many of them, especially if you're in a certain neighborhood or you're dressed in a certain way. And, you know, and that goes into stereotyping or profiling. And so because we're profiled in such a way, it then makes it very hard for me not to profile officers, because I'm constantly having to deal with this.
Well, there again, Michael, you get into the divide we've been talking about between the community and the officers wearing blue. Amy, go ahead, please.
Michael, thank you. I just wanted to jump in here and pivot to Mark Hoy and say, do you guys talk about that? Is that a particular strategy, like you're going to armor up and put on the sunglasses? Is this something that you or you know your fellow officers have done in the past as sort of a way to present this aura of authority on the street?
I would think that has happened, and I will say that I've known of it to happen in different scenarios as well. And again, it's the educational level of doing that is more prohibitive and long-term damaging, rather than going out and establishing that contact and speaking to a subject, no matter how they look, what they're wearing that day. And my fellow panelist here says, you know, waving to officers and things like that. In my early training, that was one thing that was ingrained in my head, is you will wave, you will make sure you make eye contact, that kind of thing, because you never know who you're going to deal with. You never know who that person is. That person could be a director. That could be just a regular salt-of-the-earth person. But you never know, because that person you're waving to then has a better experience that they can go on, and next time you come into contact with that person, they may help you in a scenario. They may do something that you wouldn't expect any other person to do for you.
RD from San Francisco, who's white, writes, I am a white Benicia resident. That's an area in around San Francisco, I would assume, Michael?
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that right? Benicia?
Benicia.
I am more wary of approaching a police officer, say, for directions or information than I was in my youth. They now drive militarized, dark-colored SUVs instead of the humble Crown Victorias available to the citizenry, and the police I encounter feel more like representatives of an occupying army than members of my own community. This feeling is only intensified when I visit cities with larger communities of color, like Vallejo or Oakland.
Sorry, it's Vallejo.
Vallejo.
I want to teach you about the Bay Area, Amy, as best we can.
I apologize, Bay residents.
I have the advantage of being from Cleveland, so I have, you know.
Right.
Let me bring another caller into this. So we've got lots of people who want to speak to us by phone, and this is Jonathan from San Francisco. Jonathan, join us.
Hey, what's going on? So happy to be on the show. This is a topic I feel very passionately about, so thank you for having me on. What I'm noticing with this whole conversation is a lack of comparison between how most law enforcement are raised versus how most people in black communities are raised. Now, I don't think any amount of training, if you must, can actually fix this. Now, I say that because I grew up in a very mixed military background environment where there was order, economic freedom, plenty of health care, healthy food, you name it. And kids, you know, they encounter different cultures and gain different perspectives all the time. Now, I think a lot of people are also ignoring how most officers, which, by the way, are a lot of former military, are ignoring how the two different sides are raised. Now, when I got out of the military, that's when I moved to an all-black community. I had never seen kids cursing. I had never seen drug abuse. I had never seen depression, the lack of education, all of which I firmly believe is an effect of a lack of economic freedom. But it was a stark difference between the two communities. There were no jobs readily available at every corner. Nobody owned anything, you know. And if you wanted a good job, you had to go to a neighboring city with its own non-black residents who were looking for work as well, who most likely got the job. And that creates a stark difference in viewpoints between police officers and community of color. For one, you don't see police patrolling non-black neighborhoods day in and day out just looking for a crime. They wait on a call. People are at work. You know, in non-black communities, people are usually at work at jobs that they were groomed for. And in black communities, you don't have that. In non-black communities, they're usually looking for people who look and act and dress like them. And when they don't see something like that, it's a tick off in their head when they go, this person doesn't belong here.
Jonathan, excuse me, you made a good cogent description of the divide that exists. We have Jim Shannon here with us in studio. I'd like to get his take, particularly since we're talking about Oakland for Clevelanders and Cleveland for Oaklanders and the Bay Area and so forth. And what about this divide as he described it? I mean, in terms of the police focusing on the black areas of Oakland.
Well, they have to be trained and educated about the African-American community. And probably more importantly, or as important, we need officers from these communities to be hired and made part of the police force.
But the whole Ryder case suggested that there was too much focus on the black community and there were abuses that resulted from that.
Well, in the Ryder's case, we had city leaders saying they wanted the corners cleaned up. It's just like when Giuliani talked about this in New York. These are young people, and they're very impressionable. I'm talking about the police. And when they hear city and state leaders talk about, I want these corners cleaned up by any means necessary, what goes through their mind is maybe different than what's intended, and the end result is the issue with the plunger in New York or the riders in Oakland, where they feel that they're doing what's wanted by the power structure, and violations of the Constitution result. So especially city leaders have to be very careful the way they talk about what they want the police to do. We all want to crime to go down. We all want safe neighborhoods, but the way that's communicated to police is extremely important.
Well, we've got a caller from Oakland, Gary, who says he's been threatened and beaten by the Ryders and the OPD. Gary, join us. Let's hear your story.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of frustrating just to hear, you know, you got one side you know, acting like this, like it ain't a problem, and you got the side that experiencing all this, you know. I mean, since the age 12, you know, I grew up in a beat where, you know, the riders, you know, they patrolled the beat. And friends, I got a friend that was arrested 16 times by Vasquez. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And Vasquez, I'm 12, he threatened me. I walk up, he talking to my dad. He tells me to get out of here before he slapped me. You know, that's one incident. Beat by the riders, handcuffed by the riders. Laid on my stomach by the riders and hit with one hand by while being held down by six, beat by another.
All right, Gary, I thank you for that call. I want to actually go back to Amy Eddings. I wanted to hear what you had to say, but Amy, some more comments perhaps from listeners.
Well, and I'm wondering if this might address what this gentleman is talking about. Ben from San Francisco writes, the problem with this issue is that we are trying to find national solutions for local problems. Police forces are overstretched by their duties that are ever growing. Jim, Shannon, we started with you. We'll give you the last word on that. You know, it's a paramilitary force, police officers. Maybe the thing to do is to just have commanders who really lay down the law, so to speak, with their officers, beef up their internal affairs bureaus, and get to the bottom of this, because ultimately it's those commanding officers who control the patrol cop and pay their salary.
Well, I think the message from the top is critically important. The chief, the tone they set in the police department, the conduct of the commanders, which we're having a problem right now with in Oakland, is critical to conveying the right message to what essentially are young people out of high school who are just joining the force.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's it for our conversation. You've been listening to Swap Talk here at KQED in San Francisco. We were joined by Jim Shannon, civil rights lawyer based in Oakland, who was one of the lawyers who brought the lawsuit that led to federal oversight of the Oakland Police Department. Thank you.
And here at WCPN in Cleveland, I was joined by Mark Hoy, a law enforcement professional who has served in roles ranging from a basic police officer to agency administrator for 14 years, and Kareem Henton, a founding member of Black Lives Matter Cleveland. Thank you both for joining me today.
And thank you, Amy Eddings.
Thank you, Michael Krasny. I've enjoyed my time talking to your folks in the Bay Area.
Similar. Ditto.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.